This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from BFM 89.9. I'm Meera Sivasudhi, The Bigger Picture's Health and Living, the show where we take a look at how to live a better, longer and more productive life. Now, after 8 years on the air, we're bringing the show to you live on the ground, a whole day with the experts debunking myths behind heart disease and diabetes, tackling the perils of aging, addressing our love affair with food, and of course, George will be there talking about sperm. So join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on Saturday, 2nd of April. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Good evening, I'm Ezra Zayed, and today we're celebrating World Water Day, and I'll be speaking to artist Sharon Chin about her comic journalism project, and it explores water issues in Malaysia. Now, Sharon, she received support from the Christian Jit Astro Fund for this project, and it's titled In the Land That Never Was Dry. First, Sharon travels with the NGO Light Up Borneo to explore how micro-hydro generators are supplying electricity to Long Pasia, and that's located in the deep interiors of Sipitang in Sabah. You're now going to hear an excerpt of her piece. It's titled Currents, Water Power in the Interiors of Sabah.
Two rivers meet in the village of Long Pasia. One, the colour of black coffee, the other, milk tea. Further down from this nexus, a contraption bobs on the surface of the river. It looks precarious. A platform housing a slotted metal wheel, secured against the current by cables, stretched across either bank. It's a floating hydro generator, and it can produce up to 3 kilowatts of power at full capacity. Theoretically, that's enough for 50 old-fashioned incandescent bulbs that needs 60 watts each, or 375 of the far more efficient LED bulbs that use only 8 watts to produce brighter light. You could run 2.5 refrigerators instead, or 4 rice cookers, or 20 TVs. Your MacBook Air charger needs 45 watts, so you could plug in 66 of those at a time. It isn't perfect. A log might collide and get stuck, and wattage can fluctuate with water levels. During my visit, a pulley became slack, causing the lights in our homestay to flicker and click. But I found an inexplicable beauty in this most practical and not especially complicated piece of technology. The white glow of each bulb seemed to hold the heartbeat of the river. I'd charge my iPhone with its power. At night, I heard its low roar, flowing 50 feet from where I slept.
I spoke to Sharon Chin via Skype on how her project first came about. Hi Sharon, how are you?
Hey, I'm good.
How are things over there at Port Dickson?
Yeah, they're great. A bit hot, but I think that goes for the whole country, so.
Yeah. Is there something in the background that you hear?
Yeah, there are planes sometimes that go past.
Okay. So how did this idea for your illustrated series, In the Land That Never Was Dry, how did it first come about?
Well, actually, it was the start of 2014, so that's 2 years ago now. And Port Dickson didn't get rain for 4 months, which really freaked me out. I've never had that experience before, that experience of waiting for rain. And it was a very alien feeling. This feeling really was so strange because I've never felt it before. You know, since we live in a tropical country, rain is sort of, it's as regular as the newspaper, you know, coming to your house. So 4 months is really a long time to go without rain. All the grass died, and then it's sort of like the colors of the landscape changed. Everything became from green, went to brown. And I realized too that how essential rain and the weather is and how much we take it for granted. Because even if you planted your own food, if there's no rain, the soil cracks, you can't grow anything. So that's when, you know, I just really started to think about water and think quite deeply about it and realized that I have very little knowledge of how the water you know, the process of how water comes down from the sky and then comes out of my tap. So that was kind of the beginning.
And what do illustrations, especially in the form of comics, what do they bring to serious reporting when it comes to journalism?
Yeah, I think, you know, these days when we see a photo, we can't tell what it's telling anymore. You know, we can't tell if it's real. We don't know if it's a meme or if it's been altered or it's a composite or whatever. So I see drawing as like almost a fairer, not a more truthful way to tell a story, but almost a fairer way to tell a story, because the subjectivity is built into the way the image is made, which is, you know, it comes out of my hand. So there's not this promise or expectation that it's going to be the objective truth anyway. But I found that I'm able to tell a kind of truth, or the truth as I saw it. And I find that sort of personal narrative in the story is what I hope makes it connect to people.
And it probably makes it a lot more accessible in the most basic of ways, because we're talking about a very basic issue. And, you know, for a lot of folks, perhaps they might have started reading comics before they actually started reading to read a book.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually really want to experiment with, you know, all sorts of different forms of combining like serious reporting with drawn images. So like making GIFs, for example, you know, like animated images, or the idea that maybe you could, you know, animate an essay, like maybe a 2,000 word essay into, you know, a 3-minute animation, like stuff like that really excites me. So, yeah.
Inherently within the comic world, one of the branches is, you know, where the forces of good go up against the forces of evil. Was that conscious?
Well, not in the comics that I like. The forces of good and evil are definitely not that clear cut. So it's not the superhero supervillain comics that I love. It's really much more complex stories that I like, and also alternative comics. So that's really the comics that I grew up with.
But the medium and the issue at hand, they really do fit together. I mean, it's nice to write a 500 word piece, but this really sort of captures the imagination of the reader a lot easier, I would imagine.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think pretty much every Malaysian grew up reading comics. You know, it's either Dragon Ball Z or Lao Fu Zi or Gila Gila, Ujang, you know, and of course Lat, you know, you can't forget Lat. So we're already really familiar with the form. I just think it's that unfamiliarity of, I think people don't expect to see serious reporting in comic form. I think more and more it's catching on. So I'm really excited about, you know, some of the local creators who are doing this kind of work, like Mimi Mashut, 7 Days in Kuala Terengganu, for example, or Zan Asli's Adventures of KLI in Afghanistan. You know, this is a great start, and I just love to see more people get into it.
So what's the process, or how long does it take to complete each piece? Where do you begin in the creative sense?
Oh, that's the thing. Like a piece of illustrated journalism like this, from beginning to end, takes a pretty long time for me anyway. I'd say from beginning to end probably takes about a month, you know, because I'm doing the research and I'm also booking my own flights. I'm going out into the field where I'll spend maybe, you know, up to 2 weeks. And then I'm doing interviews when I'm in the field. I'm taking lots of notes. I'm also making drawings and sketches. And then when I come back, I put the piece together, write it and then draw it, send the draft to my editor, who fact checks it. And then, you know, all that has to happen before we hit publish. So it's a pretty long process, but it's the best for learning how to do something, because you literally build it from scratch. And I also have to shout out to my former editor at Postcode, where these pieces were published, Ling Lau. So having an editor Working with an editor has been really great. She's actually responsible for making these pieces what they are. Because as an artist, you know, you're used to working in a really solitary way. So having an editor push you, especially to clarify something, you know, this part isn't clear, or this part is a bit fuzzy, or you need to go back and, you know, like, check whether this, what did this person mean when they said this thing, you know. So, an editor is pretty important.
After this, we'll hear more about the stories behind each of these illustrated pieces in Sharon's journalism series, In the Land That Never Was Dry. Stay tuned to the evening edition as we celebrate World Water Day, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
You're back on the evening edition with me, Ezra Zayed, and in celebration of World Water Day, I'm speaking to artist Sharon Chin about her comic journalism project. It's called In the Land That Never Was Dry. Before the break, we heard about Sharon's experience in Long Pasia with the NGO Light Up Borneo about how micro-hydro generators are lighting up rural villages, and she wrote about it in a piece titled Currents, Water Power in the Interiors of Sabah. Have a listen.
Richard, our driver from Long Pasia, navigates the giant ruts and rotting bridges like a boss. He's been making this trip a few times a week for more than a decade. Halfway through our journey, we pass a truck stuck deep in the mud. It's an omen. Not long after, at the foot of a wicked incline, we share the same fate. There was nothing for it but get down and tug. Staring down the wrong end of an accelerating truck, my hands raw from pulling a towing strap. I felt buzzed with adrenaline, exhilarated, proud even. Now you've had the true Long Pasia experience, said Richard, after we'd successfully plucked ourselves from the mire. Tourists love it, slipping and sliding, but for us, orang kampung.
And to tell us more about her story, here's Sharon Chin.
So Light Up Borneo is an NGO that works to install micro-hydroelectricity in the interiors of Sabah. And very consciously, I wanted my first story to be set in East Malaysia, because I'm a stranger to that part of Malaysia. So Light Up Borneo organizes these trips that are open to the public to their project sites. So since their projects are connected, intimately connected to water in some way, but using water to generate electricity, I thought that, okay, this is an interesting subject for the first piece. So I just called them and went along on one of those trips.
Now, a few months ago, we spoke to the founder of Light Up Borneo, Ong Boon Kyong, as well as project volunteer Kwan Eng, right here on the Evening Edition. Boon Kyong explained to us why micro-hydro generators are a far cheaper alternative to extending power grids to deep rural areas. And here's that conversation with Caroline and Uma.
If you look at the official pronouncement, It costs over 30,000 ringgit for the government to extend power, the main grid, to just one house.
Right.
30,000 ringgit.
Right.
Whereas for 30,000 ringgit, we could have done one or two projects that can power up maybe a whole village, a small village, maybe 10, 20, 30 houses.
Right. So the conventional methods are just too costly. Then.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So if there's any way these interior folks were to get power, it would be through standalone generator rather than extending the grid. Well, we have a number of ways to cut down costs. One thing is, if let's say we have a standalone power generator, like a hydro generator, it doesn't involve a long length of cable that connect the main grid to the village. And we are talking about very long distances. So this is one area that we can cut down costs considerably. And the second thing is actually, at least at this stage, we are working with volunteers. So there is not a wage component in our rollout of these projects. We have been getting donation from the public and also donation of energy from people like Kwan. So if they were to be employed, maybe the cost will be jacked up considerably. But we are able to get free services like that.
But here's the thing. It's a challenging task to build these micro-generators.
There are two aspects to the logistical challenges. One is to move things from town to the location.
Yeah.
Normally, it may involve long driving or boat ride or just walking.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to walk over, say, a few hours, you may find it difficult. And what if you have to carry some heavy goods on your back? That's even worse.
Yeah.
But most of the time, we find the villagers are able to help because they really want light. The human's quest for fire is still driving them forward. Then the other aspect is actually within the village, the water source could be a couple of kilometers. Our longest record is like 6 kilometers away from the village.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to haul this thing uphill to the water source. So these two aspects are quite challenging, but we are trying to solve them, at least in one case, in the village itself. Instead of trying to derive the water from a waterfall like a few kilometers away, now we have designed a new method of generating electricity. We can actually generate electricity from a flowing river, because most of the river flow very close to the village. So if we have a floating hydro generator that can generate electricity, we cut away a lot of the cables, and also we don't need to use pipes, which is the most expensive component of a hydro.
And here is Sharon again, telling us about that difficult journey to Long Pasia. And so you wrote about the arduous journey to Long Pasia, and there's a moment where there's the truck in which you travel actually got stuck in mud and you had to help pull out. Is this almost a regular daily experience for the residents over there in Long Pasia?
Yeah, absolutely. The road to Long Pasia is it's really a thing to be seen and to be experienced for yourself. So it was like a thrill ride for me because it was so muddy. So the truck got stuck in the mud and we had to like tow it out of the mud with a towing strap. And, it was a little bit fun, it was a little bit exciting, but when you think about, you know, people needing to make that trip up and down, maybe, you know, several times a week, then the reality of things begins to set in. Yeah, that was pretty eye-opening experience, I have to say.
So being in their shoes, with the folks at Long Pasia, what was it like to stay in the village, keeping in mind that there was such a limited power supply?
Yeah, so what was interesting was that the homestay where we stayed was powered by a microhydro generator that was sort of floating on the river behind the house. So when I plugged in to charge my iPhone, there was a sense of it being actually powered by the river, which was, you know, thinking of it like that, it really made me realize that power comes from somewhere. All the things that we have, all our fans and air conditioning and even our malls, that electricity has a source. It comes from somewhere and it always comes from the earth. And the same goes for water as well. One of the important perspectives that I got from being in Long Pasia was this idea that actually the interior areas or places that aren't connected to the electricity grid yet have a lot to teach us about how we use our resources. Because if you have one grid that services a large area, if that grid goes down, then the entire area doesn't have power. But if you have a sort of micro decentralized or distributed system of, you know, small generators, then it's much more robust, actually. And you actually don't need that much power. So in a way, you know, the demand and the supply, because you're so close to the supply, you sort of adjust the demand to, you know, the capacity of the supply, because you can see how much supply there is. So I found, you know, this idea especially really relevant for us in West Malaysia, which is, you know, far more connected.
What was the biggest difference for you in observing how folks were living out in Long Pasir to perhaps how you lived your life once upon a time in the city? What were the biggest, I guess, comparisons that you could observe?
I think one of them was a sense of time, like a sense of rhythm and time that is very much connected to whether there's rain that day or whether it's cloudy that day. So, for example, if there's solar panels, then, you know, if it's been cloudy and rainy for a few days, then you might not have that much electricity saved up in the solar bank. So, you know, there's this sense of contingency, but it just becomes a part of life. It's not an inconvenience. You just sort of adapt to that rhythm. So I think in urban areas, you tend to lose that sense of, you know, we're somehow connected to the landscape, because, you know, when it's night, you can just turn on the lights, or, you know, you've got internet going 24/7. So, yeah, that was one of the big contrasts, I think.
After the break, we'll look at another piece in Sharon's series, In the Land That Never Was Dry. And this time, she digs into the 100-year-old wells of Kampung Haka Mantin. It's World Water Day, folks. Stay tuned to the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
You're still here. Good. Now, if you're listening to this podcast while on the treadmill, you're already off to a good start. If you're not, don't forget to join us at BFM's Health and Living Live 2016 on the 2nd of April to find out how you can live a better, healthier life. Go on and register at bfm.my/health.
Hey folks, I'm Ezra Zayed on the Evening Edition and welcome back to the show. Today is World Water Day and we're speaking to artist Sharon Chin about her comic journalism series, In the Land That Never Was Dry. Now her second piece in the series, it's called Deep Water, the 100-year-old wells of Kampung Haka Mantin. Have a listen.
Grandma Kong's well is in the corner of the kitchen, at the back of the house. For 100 years, the villagers of Kampung Haka Mantin have used well water for washing, cooking and drinking.
Got well, what for use river water? So dirty. People bathed there, threw chicken feces and everything. The well had never gone dry. Without rain, the water level just goes lower. Now we got pump. Last time I had to draw water using the hand for grandmother and uncle to make rice wine. Father sold the wine on his bicycle, 40 cents for one big bottle. Brewing wine was very fragrant. The police smelled it and came. Younger brother got caught by the police, but father didn't. Open the door, they shouted. When younger brother came back, his legs were black and blue. We didn't stop brewing wine. The police came again and asked younger brother to follow them. He refused to go, but instead drowned himself in a lake near the rubber plantation. When? 30 years ago, lo?
Almost every house has its own well. Although some were dug more recently, like Auntie Lai's, she uses the water to make pickled mangoes and yellow rice wine.
You have to use small green mangoes. Soak first in salt water, then sugar water. That's it. No chemicals or colouring like what you get out there. The well water is very good. You can see all the way down to the sandy bottom.
Now, when you view it and read it online, the website is postcode.my, the reading experience really takes you deeper and deeper into this well, as illustrated by Sharon. And so I ask her more about this story. So your second piece was about the 100-year-old wells. This is in Kampung Haka. Can you just give us, for listeners who haven't had the chance to read the piece, could you just describe it a little bit?
Sure. Okay, so Kampung Haka is in Mantin, which is in Negeri Sembilan. And it's a heritage village, or it's a village that's been around for about 100 years or at least six generations. And it's got a history of tin mining as well. So Mantin Valley was very rich in tin. And this kampung, this Haka Kampung has been under threat from developers, and they've been challenging the developer through legal means, but also through running lots of cultural programs. So Rakan Mantin is a really great initiative that organizes lots of activities and events. They're sort of like based around the idea of preserving or keeping alive those cultural traditions. And one of the great things about Kampong Kapa is that they have been using groundwater, so they have wells that have been there since the very beginning. And the villagers still use groundwater or water from these wells for cooking, for washing. When Negeri Sembilan had like a really serious drought a couple of years ago, Kampong Haka was fine. You know, they had water because they were getting their water from the ground.
For folks who've never been to Kampong Haka, how would you best describe it?
Right. So Kampong Haka is a village. It's full of wooden houses, and the houses are very beautiful. There are certain details on the houses, you know, that really makes each house extremely individual, but it's also a very close-knit community. So, like, there's this idea of visiting. So, like, when you walk around the village, you go from house to house, and then, like, you go and, you know, sit in the house and, like, maybe gossip for a little while with the people in one house and move on to the other. And then, you know, you have, like, snacks here and there, and then a whole afternoon passes. And that's, you know, how you keep the ties going in the community. And also, you know, it's very trendy now to talk about organic farming and also, you know, neighborhood spirit and things like that. But this is, you know, it already exists in Kampong Haka.
Sharon tells us how drawing water from a well was a different experience from just turning on the taps, as most of us do these days.
Most of the houses also have pumps now. So, when you pump up the water from the well and then it just comes out of the tap. And the water is great. You know, it's sort of got this, it's not completely clear. It's like sort of barley-like consistency, but it's perfectly safe to drink.
And so, as a, I guess, you know, as a consumer, almost, like, how does that experience compare to whether you're pumping or drawing water from the well versus, you know, just turning on the tap?
Yeah, again, it's this, you know, it's this close connection to the source of your water. So once you know where it's coming from, you become a lot more aware of how much of it you're using. Whereas if you don't know where it's coming from, you just turn on the tap and then, you know, it keeps on running. But it's not infinite, you know. And I think that's one of the biggest lessons that I've gotten out of doing these stories, is that water is the most important resource, but it's also a really finite resource.
Now, here's what Sharon's done with the story. The threats to our groundwater is in fact symbolic of the dangers that are being faced by Kampong Haka's heritage. And Sharon tells us how the idea for this metaphor came about.
You know, there's been talk recently, especially as whenever the levels in our dams fall, there's always talk of utilizing groundwater because Malaysia actually has quite a large reserve of groundwater. But when I was researching the story, I found out that actually Malaysia gets more than enough rain. We get plenty of rain, really. It's just that we use too much water. That's the long and short of it. So there's actually no reason to tap into our groundwater resources, because those, you know, once you do that, it sort of sets off a whole, it's unpredictable what might happen. You know, it impacts the landscape in ways that we can't really predict. So I thought that it was maybe a really cool metaphor. You know, these sort of 100-year-old wells, connecting these 100-year-old wells, which connect this to our groundwater, which is also a kind of, you know, it's a kind of treasure. It's a natural treasure, but Kampong Haka represents a cultural treasure. So I thought, you know, you could use water as this quite powerful metaphor to link the two. So actually, phase one of this development has already been completed. So basically, that part of the kampong has been completely leveled, and new buildings have gone up in its place. And there's no trace. When you look at that new development, you have no idea of what was there before. And so for me, I thought it was a really strong image because, you know, when the village is gone, you're cut off from the source of the groundwater. So you cut, there are no more wells, you know, it's been like, it's been paved over. So you can't access your groundwater directly. But also you can't access, you know, that cultural knowledge or that cultural history that's also been wiped clean. So it's this idea of appreciating, and then when you cannot access, it's very hard to appreciate what you can't see or what you no longer have access to. So materials, you know, sort of like stories that what I've written are, you know, as much as I'm happy with that piece, it's no replacement for the real thing of being able to, you know, draw water from the well yourself and being able to walk around that village and just feeling, you know, just seeing for yourself what it's like to walk in a place which has like, a century of history behind it.
I also asked Sharon what she observed about the sentiment among the villagers of Kampung Hakka.
It was interesting. There was, I felt that there was a mixture of resignation, but also resistance. And so, you know, it's quite precarious right now because in many ways, the inhabitants of the Kampung need to believe themselves that what they have is worth keeping, that what they have, you know, is worth, I don't like to say preserve, because preserving means, you know, freezing something in time, but it's really looking at how to move forward together without, you know, completely wiping it out and starting something new. I think that's an approach that we love in Malaysia. You know, we love, that's our relationship to modernity, is just, you know, let's start again from zero. Let's build it anew. Whereas I think it's very important to think about, you know, how we can move forward into the future and change and evolve. So I think as more and more people find out about Kampung Hakka, and more visitors go there, then the inhabitants themselves, they sort of get their self-esteem back. You know, that sense of cultural identity is strengthened, and we strengthen it mutually for each other. So I think that's pretty essential in the fight. It's not as simple as, you know, the villagers just fighting against the developers. You know, that's definitely part of it, and it's an ongoing legal battle. But it really is that there's really a deeper cultural question here, I think, you know, and a real chance to learn as well while it's still there.
That's artist Sharon Chin telling us about her illustrated stories in the series In the Land That Never Was Dry. And in a while, we'll hear about her latest piece on the relationship between water and political power. Folks, it's World Water Day. It's the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Building fit Malaysians, BFM 89.9.
You're back with me, Ezra Zayed, on the evening edition, and as we celebrate World Water Day, we're going to hear more about the latest piece by artist Sharon Chin in her comic journalism series, In the Land That Never Was Dry. You're now working on your third piece, and it's about connecting water pipes in rural Sarawak. I know you're still working on it, so is there something that you can tell us about this project?
Yes. So this piece, I'm still working on it. Actually, it's been a little hard to grapple with because this particular story. So I went with Impian Sarawak, which is a NGO started to provide projects in rural areas in Malaysia. They've done a few projects in West Malaysia, but mostly it's been in East Malaysia, mostly in Sarawak. So what I like about this story is that together with the first two stories, then, you know, there'll be a story about Sabah, there'll be a story about Sarawak, and also one about Semenanjung Malaysia. So I think what makes the Sarawak story a bit more complex is the political aspect about how sort of rural development projects and politics, the interplay between, you know, these two things was it was a source of conflict for me, just in terms of thinking through it and, you know, what it means for me to go there as an observer and also a volunteer in the project. Like I help make the I help with the connecting the pipes. Yeah, that's really the heart of the story, I think. How, and that's another thing that I love about this subject as well, water, is that it really, other than being a powerful metaphor, you really get to explore both federal and municipal politics, so that's local politics, and how that intersects with people, place, landscape, and natural resources. So it's there's a wholeness here, whereas I feel that, you know, we may have become used to thinking, you know, compartmentalizing these things, but actually they're really interconnected. Actually, every NGO has an agenda of their own. With Impian Sarawak, the agenda is definitely to help people in rural areas, connecting with small projects, you know, connecting water pipes, for example, or building micro hydro, just like Light Up Borneo. But there's also another agenda involved, and that's a political agenda. And this is already well documented. So one of the reasons was to win over the hearts and minds of the rural population. So, I mean, the source of conflict for me is really, you know, navigating these two agendas, where it could, you know, on the one hand, you could see it as a tit for tat. I give you water pipes, you give me votes. But on the other hand, it's also, I mean, the way that I'm seeing the story is that political parties are another way of pooling resources or channeling resources, and there's to places that need it. So I think there are imbalances of power here between the political actors, who are the politicians, basically, the residents of the places where these that the recipients of these projects, and then you have us, the volunteers, coming in, you know, to so-called help. So to be able to get to the heart of the story, which is to be able to see the common humanity, but without glossing over these power imbalances between, you know, these between each of us who are coming from very different contexts. I think that's where the conflict lies for me, is that, you know, I want to treat everyone as a human being, basically.
Sharon, what have you gained personally from these projects?
Well, I've gained a whole new appreciation for journalism and journalists. It's a hard job. It takes a lot of time. It costs a lot of money. So that part has been a real education for me. And the other is that, you know, it's a whole white Malaysia out there. There are a lot of stories. Just the sheer range of people, I think, that I've encountered just in, you know, these three stories, and it's only three, has been kind of mind-blowing. And I think there's real value for artists or anyone really to sort of get off the internet for a while and go out there and just observe, really. Observe, participate. And, you know, if you want to tell a story about it, like, I don't have journalistic training. So, yeah, anyone can tell a good story, I think.
Sharon, so what's next for you after you complete your third piece?
There are a lot more stories I want to do. So, like, a scientist friend of mine is doing consulting on seagrass. And that's not coral reefs, but seagrass, which is actually known as the rainforests of the sea, and which do a lot more to absorb carbon than coral reefs, actually. And the seagrass is quite a banal thing, but it's now under threat because of land reclamation happening on the coast, one of the coasts on the peninsula. So that's a story I want to do. So there's just, you know, lots more stories I want to do, and I see this series sort of, like, you know, going on for a while.
Sharon's new writing, it's called Pipe Dreams, and it's due to be completed soon. Head over to her website at sharonchin.com to look out for it. And for more information on the other stories that we discussed, head over to our website, it's bfm.my. This show was produced by Josie Liu, and special thanks to Esme Joseph and Samantha Un for lending their voices to the show. I'm Ezra Zayed on the Evening Edition. Thanks for tuning in, and happy World Water Day, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.